Welcome to By the Well, where we delve into the lectionary readings for the week to help you preach the word in your communities. I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Robin Whittaker. And we're here in Lent week one, and we have a richness of biblical stories to work with today. Genesis 2, the story of Adam and Eve, as it's known, and being cast out of the Garden of Eden. We have Matthew 4, the temptation of Jesus. And we also need to look at Romans 5, because that's where Paul picks up this story of Adam and relates it to why Christ came. So I think as preachers, there's immediately decisions to make about what to focus on. And I think Romans pairs perfectly with Genesis, and maybe Matthew 4 is its own sermon. But we're going to try and touch on a few things here, because ultimately all these readings ask some big questions. Why do we suffer? Why do we die? What does it mean to be human? Why do we as humans feel alienation from God, from one another, and even perhaps with creation?
So these are big foundational stories, Robin, probably enough for about three podcasts.
I think so.
We'll just keep it to this normal brief. And I will be mounting an argument in it when our focus on Genesis 2 that we extend the reading beyond the lectionary suggestion and take chapter 3 up to verse 11 instead of verse 7.
But we'll get back to that later. So tell us about Genesis 2, Fran. This is a problematic story in some ways.
Well, I think it is just because of the popular cultural overlays that have been we've been formed in over years and years.
Yep.
So the first might be that God created some perfect creation, completely unchanging and an idol.
So these are things we're going to dispel about the text. Yep. What else have you got?
That's a bit simplistic, that humans did live in some sort of luxurious paradise, that the evil serpent figure brought evil into the world. And that's connected to another misunderstanding of the text, that it's a story about the origin of evil.
Yeah.
And it's not really.
No.
And one of the last ones would be that it was the woman alone who didn't obey and led to all the disaster.
Yep, that's right, which has been used in all sorts of ways to blame women for being more inclined to fall into temptation.
But before addressing those individually, I think it's probably really important to try in a sermon and in conversation generally to rehabilitate the word myth and the understanding of myth, because we live in a world where we have dismissive phrases like, oh, that's just a myth, when something isn't some scientific fact.
Yep.
When in fact our language about God and faith is mostly using mythical and metaphorical language, and that myth actually refers to a profound truth, sort of a naming of the drama of reality as it's going on now. So that what we read in that story of Genesis 2, okay, we're going to look at what the authors might have intended with that text, but the fact is that it does name what we're like.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, 3,000 years later.
Yeah, so we're going to call this story a myth, but by that we by no means mean it is not profoundly true and pointing to some deep theological claims about God that are at the basis of Christian faith and tradition, Jewish faith and tradition. So just to be really clear about that, that's not to denigrate the text in any kind of way.
Well, the opposite.
Yes.
Actually.
Yeah, exactly. But when we acknowledge it as myth, it also means we're acknowledging that the text will only answer certain kinds of questions. This is not a scientific textbook about how the world came to be.
Or an historical account.
Or a historical account or any of those sorts of things. It's doing something differently. So we're going to try and unpack that. Fran, you mentioned one of the sort of misunderstandings is that this is some sort of perfect static world. What do we see in the text that would contradict such a view?
Well, I think we have to go a bit before how the lectionary is set today and see that at the border of creation is chaos. So the brooding waters are pushed aside. So they're there. And certainly that world beyond Eden is of that kind too. So that when God creates, it doesn't obliterate that. It just pushes it aside.
Yeah.
But also things like when God is seeking a helper for Adam, it takes quite a few tries I mean, this is a trial and error process going on.
All the animals that get made first.
Yeah. So those couple of points, I think, indicate that it's not some sort of simple perfection.
No. And, I mean, it's worth saying at this point that the story we encounter in Genesis 2, 4 onwards is quite a different story. Scholars agree by a different author or set of authors than Genesis 1.
Yeah.
So we need to sort of bracket out Genesis 1, which is this watery place with be fruitful and multiply and everything's blessed and good. That's a very different – it's doing something theologically different. This story almost has the Garden of Eden as a royal garden. It's almost walled because – there's a place beyond the garden, as you've said, that people can be thrown out to.
Mm.
So, yes, the garden might be, you know, not – I don't want to use the word perfect. I'm resisting that. But a beautiful place where this human is designed to live with God. But there is also a place outside that. What was your other point that this is – you said something about work and
– oh, well, it was that this assumption that humans lived in some sort of a –
Bahamas.
Palm Cove type Mauritius.
Resort style
Resort,
living.
Yeah.
It does sound appealing.
Port Douglas. Yeah. When in fact they're working.
Yes.
So, well, Adam is given, you know, to till the soil and to work alongside God.
Which is an interesting reflection on our sort of, if we take this as a sort of imagining of theologically, you know, our role as humans, it's to work with God.
Mm.
So it's not to live a life of reclining with cocktails in hand, unfortunately.
No.
But it actually is. But there's also something profound in that, I mean, in a deeper sense, of that we are part of God's work.
Yeah, which means we shouldn't be destroying the creation for our own ends, which
true,
is a whole
true.
Other conversation.
But it's also, I think, very affirming of humans that God imagines a world in which we are part of that work.
Yeah,
that we are
in his likeness or in God's likeness.
It might be worth saying at this point too that we're trying to avoid the word Adam a bit, if you haven't noticed. Robert Alter in his translation simply talks about the human. The human is put in the garden and the human toils. And that's because this word for Adam is the Adam in Hebrew, and it's a play on words because Adama is soil or earth. So the Adam is made out of the Adama. And some scholars call it an earthling. So he's a human, doesn't necessarily have gender or sex yet. So I quite like Robert Alter using the human here at first.
I'm interested, Robin, and you might say that's not relevant right now, Fran, but because I know that Robert uses woman for Eve.
Yes.
But Eve means life, doesn't it?
It does, the living one. It's hard to give a direct translation to. But this isn't in the lectionary reading this week, so we won't dwell on it, but there's an argument to be made that we have this human and it's only when the human, the rib is separated out and the Eve woman is made that gender and sex enter the equation.
Right.
So, yeah, so it gets complicated.
It does.
Yeah. You talked about evil as well. I mean, one of the ways we know we're in a mythic text is we have a talking animal, right?
Yeah.
Should be a clue. And this animal is called a snake or a serpent who's cunning, but not a Satan or a devil. What, is it an image for evil? How do we make sense of this serpent image here?
Well, serpents and snakes appear regularly in ancient creation myths, do they not? I believe in the Babylonian creation myth for Gilgamesh, the serpent prevented his attempt to make all humans more immortal.
Yep.
So they seem to be bearers of apparently good spiritual news, but perhaps not necessarily.
Yeah. Well, they're complicated because in the Hebrew Bible they both end life and are symbols of life at points. So the story of Moses holding
In Numbers,
that's right. So Moses holds up the serpent. That's the sign God tells him, hold up the serpent, and that becomes a point of healing, which is why the serpent ends up in later Greek medical tradition as a symbol of healing.
Yeah, and the Son of Man in John 3,
yes,
I think,
who's held up.
But that serpent in the Moses story in Numbers, the serpent initially was biting the people whinging about their situation.
Yes. So which perhaps has some commonalities here with where it ends up, that the serpent is at odds with humans when they're cast out of the garden.
But I think I'm tend to think, if I may, as a non-biblical scholar, but that it's a device here.
Yes.
It's a narrative device to really perhaps suggest that speculative theological discourse about what God wants can be a dangerous thing.
Mm.
Yep. And incidentally, I think it's Bonhoeffer who says that this question that he asks, or he reframes what God says. But the serpent said to the woman, "You will not die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil."
Mm.
Bonhoeffer called this the religious question, capital RQ, because it was really an attempt to be God but cloaked in piety.
Yes.
So you look like you're being faithful, but actually you're trying to twist what God intends.
Yeah. And that's obviously, I mean, we've talked about what this text is perhaps not, and there's still a bit more to say about that. But I think there, Fran, you're getting to one of the sort of deep truths of the text, which is there's clearly a concern that in eating from this tree, the humans will become too godlike. So in 3:5, it's that the accusation is you'll become like God, you'll know stuff. And that gets repeated later on in chapter 3, I think in verse 22, that they've become like gods. And so the word sin isn't in this text at all, but if there is a sin, if you like, if there's an overreaching of these humans, it's that they are trying to take on the nature of God.
Yeah. So my understanding is that tree of the knowledge of good and evil in Hebrew is tob and ra, good and evil.
Yeah, tov and ra.
And it encapsulates everything.
Yes. So sort of all knowledge.
There's other instances in Genesis, and I might have to look that up and come back to the show notes, but where if you don't do good or bad, you're doing nothing. So that you can't do anything without it being one or the other.
Yes. Yeah.
So it is absolutely everything. It is knowing God, knowing as God knows. Yeah.
And so I think, I mean, so I've just said there's no sin in this story. And I mean, that's to say the word isn't here. And I think, I mean, this might be a good point to talk about the problematic nature of sin, because I think we have a complex relationship with it. Too often it's reduced to something highly individual.
And sexual.
And or sexual, very moralistic, which I think is a diminished understanding.
And an punitive way to control people. So
yes.
Those predominantly Christian traditions, but not only Christian, there are other faiths which have this. It's very life-denying.
Yeah.
So we've got that. We've got that some of us have been exposed to. And then we've got what, frankly, many of our peers who don't call themselves Christian, Robin, would just think this whole thing is anachronistic and that sin is really why we're even talking about it.
Yeah. And I think part of my problem with the very traditional interpretation of this text is as if there's this incredibly neat, simple story of humans were good, they sinned and fell away from God, and then Jesus came, you know, that simple salvation kind of, I also don't like the idea of fall. And that's because within this garden, there was always the possibility for human freedom. It's not like, you know, choice and freedom and these possibilities were not built into that place. But I think we've got to get beyond that very simplistic notion. If there is a sin here in a deeper sense, it is the attempt to be godlike.
And not in the likeness of God.
Yes.
I think Brueggemann encapsulates this really helpfully.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about the anthropology or what it is to be human, the characteristics of being human before God, as this story has it, are threefold, and it's vocation, prohibition, and permission.
Okay.
And
what does that mean? Can you unpack those
a little bit? I'll try, but what he talks about is that the struggle in being human is to hold those three together.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you dropped one, you've warped everything. So, you know, if you drop the permission or and just have vocation and prohibition, that's when you have those really punitive views on sin and you're
legalistic.
There's no
kind
grace,
of,
frankly. No grace. If you lose the vocation, and by vocation he means not just those of us who are ordained by any means, but actually what is your calling before God in the world to live faithfully.
Our purpose as human beings before God.
And if you just have vocation and permission, then anything goes and you've got no boundaries and it that doesn't work either.
Yeah.
So I find that a much more creative and compelling set of categories, if we should impose them on the text, perhaps we shouldn't, but to try to talk about what's going on here. And I think that that names what goes on still for all of us all the time, is trying to hold vocation, permission and prohibition together.
And for me, one of the sort of the profound truths of this text that is as, you know, applicable today as it was however many thousands of years ago that this was written, is it speaks to the place we can find ourselves as humans, which is, you know, mortal and fragile and suffering when we don't live with God in the way we're intended. So that alienation from God has all these sorts of consequences, and I don't mean that in a punitive way, but that we live our best human selves when we live with God. And so there's just a very simple reality this story points to, is that when we're separated from God, we're separated from the source that is all goodness and life.
I said earlier on that I'd made an argument for extending the lectionary to verse 11, and actually that's come from my exposure to a fantastic sermon by Fleming Rutledge in one of her books, I think, And God Spoke to Abraham, and we'll put a link
in the notes.
But the reason for extending it is because we get that verse where God actually, God's first response to them eating that fruit is to immediately go looking for them.
Yes, where are you?
Where are you? And also allows the sowing of the fig leaf so that this sort of disruption is still loved and retained in some way.
Mm.
And also I think the good news from this week, well, every week, but is, and Fleming really points this out, that Adam, where are you? Again, we think it's our job to go on, have you found God? Where's God?
Yes, have you found Jesus?
I've lost my faith, or I've lost faith. Oh, where is it? Oh, behind the couch, you know.
Yeah.
That actually the gospel is again and again, and by that I mean the whole story, is God searching for us.
Yes.
And finding us and us and allowing ourselves to be found. So I think that is really powerful and the truth.
Yes.
So I think extending it to that verse for that reason alone is much more completing of the story.
Yeah, reading through to verse 11. I agree, and I think too it does the work of there's a danger that Christians fall into all the time of, like, we read this as a story of God casting out from the garden and punishing, and then Jesus is the answer. And there's a danger when we do that too simplistically, that the God of the Old Testament looks punitive and judgmental and Jesus is all love and light. And yet right here in this very same story of, you know, humans doing the wrong thing, is a God who comes seeking them. Yeah. So there's profound grace and movement towards, even while the humans are kind of moving away in a sense.
Yeah. And what I'd add to that too, I think is a powerful point from Fleming, which is what, and this is how it's a myth, a deeply true story about our state, is it's really not about death. It's about shame and anxiety and the reality of shame that we as humans live in all the time. Actually, that's what we're running from. So the ludicrousness of these two adults, naked adults, hiding in the bushes away from God, kind of crazy. But where are you hiding?
Yes,
it's one of her questions, and I think that makes this a very pertinent.
That could be a great sermon title. Where are you hiding?
Yeah,
yeah. Or what are you hiding?
And that makes me think too of some recent articles and conversations I've heard in the media here around how we've lost our shame.
Yeah,
people. That's really commentating on the level of political dialogue locally and globally that we're being. What's inflicted on us is these sort of non-conversations between our politicians and interviewers a lot of the time, where the politicians will just say black is white and white is black repeatedly with no shame, which is
– no.
It's interesting. It's almost like they fear more what the voters think than what God thinks of them.
Yes, yeah. Well, that
which is actually the sin again, trying to be God.
Yes.
And,
yes.
And deal with truth.
And also worrying about the wrong consequence, quite frankly.
Yeah. So I think, I hope that doesn't sound too convoluted.
No, but I think that's very real. I think, well, shame is obviously so complex and we can't probably do it justice here, but no. I am fascinated that the first response of these humans is to realize their nakedness. Mm. And that gets repeated in the text. And so there's something there about it feeling exposed. And I think, I mean, I said before, I think a lot of people don't have a sense of their own sinfulness. And I don't, having said that, I don't think it's our jobs to go out there like
no.
Christians sometimes used to and try and convince people of their sinfulness. But it partly answers why that classic evangelical kind of you've sinned and you need Jesus doesn't quite work. Because if people don't recognize that they're sinful, the needing Jesus part makes no sense. But I think what this does say is equally there's people who have a profound sense of shame, of feeling fear of exposure. There's a whole lot of other human, deep human emotions that are in this story that I think the goodness and the healing love of God can speak to. And it's not changing the story, it's perhaps just reframing it.
Yeah.
In different language and images.
I think there'd be few of us, I think, who would not look at the world now and go, something's terribly wrong.
Yeah.
A lot. We know, yeah. if we're not talking personally, if we can't talk personally and we find that too difficult because of whatever baggage we might have around sin.
Yes.
It's
we can
clearly that there is mass, there is inequality, there is competition to the point of death and so on. So we're dealing, you know, a few people would deny that.
No.
Which opens up the conversation for what did God intend? How are we participating in this? How do we resist it? What is God's hope for us? Yep. Where is God in it? Well, yes. Looking for us in the bushes, it turns out.
I mean, the other thing this story does is it actually introduces human responsibility in a way, is that if humans now know good and evil, right, if the consequence, I mean, there's lots of consequences, but one of them we might even think of as a kind of not bad thing from our perspective, is that humans now know good and evil, but with that comes responsibility. Because now if you know, if you have the ability to discern what is good and evil, it also means you can be held responsible for when you choose the evil, right? That's one of the sort of ongoing consequences. Mm. There's a state of naivety that's been taken away. And, of course, Paul picks this up. We should probably move on.
Yes, we haven't got to Romans.
Yes. Paul picks this up and he really picks up the death, which I think is in this story. I think Genesis 2 is actually more a story that explains how humans became mortal. There's an emphasis on death here and you do this, the consequence is death. And that's where Paul picks it up in Romans 5. And he makes basically an argument that's quite complicated, but I'm going to reduce it to two sentences.
All
sorry,
right.
Paul. Which is that through one man, Adam, came death for everyone, for all humans. But through one person, Christ, will come life for everyone. That's basic.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, thank you. you know, he makes a few steps along the way. But so in comparing Adam and Christ, I think Paul really is comparing here death and life. He mentions sin along the way. It's part of the picture because sin leads to death in his theological landscape. But really his emphasis, I think, is on he talks about this free gift of grace that comes in Jesus. He emphasizes, you know, that this is life for all in verse 19, which has caused some scholars to speculate, did Paul actually believe in universal salvation? He doesn't qualify that as life for all believers, but life for all.
I think he is a universalist elsewhere.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Anyway.
We'll flag that for another day. But, I mean, I think it's not supersessionist to put Romans alongside Genesis. I think Paul here is making sense of Jesus as a Jew in this tradition and saying we've all lived with this threat of death that came through Adam in our tradition, the Adam figure, and now Christ brings us life. And, of course, at the beginning of Lent, we're in that Lent is that weird season of we're supposed to be penitential, you know, doing some spiritual exercises ideally, reflecting on our own sinfulness, but it's always with the hope and promise of life. We can't not look to Easter because we are post-resurrection
exactly,
people as
yeah.
Christians. So we can In a sense, we can do that work thoroughly because we know that there is already life. We're not going to get stuck in the death and despair. Should we finish up by talking about Matthew for a few minutes?
Certainly.
All right. Temptations. Fran, do you have them?
Oh, no, none, ever.
Okay, that's easy then.
I'll make a big picture connection maybe between these two. And that is, in a way, in the story of the temptations, we have Jesus accepting his God-given identity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with struggle, we see.
Yeah, not easily.
But what we see in the Genesis 2:3 passage is Adam not accepting God-given identity and seeking something else.
I like that. So you've connected Matthew back to Genesis as well.
So you can do the small picture now that I've done the big picture.
Thank you, thank you. The nitty-gritty of Matthew 4.
Yeah.
I mean, if like us you've been ordained for a while, you might be a bit sick of preaching about the temptations every year. But one of the things that struck me in re-looking at this passage for today is that I think there's a way to talk about the temptations in the way, Fran, you just did, which is tying it back to, again, human identity and what Jesus models versus what the Adam models, but also within the wider context of Matthew's gospel. So Jesus refuses to make food for himself, even though he's been fasting. He refuses to test God by throwing himself down to death just so he can be saved for the sake of it. And he refuses the kingdom, the power that the diabolos, the devil here, offers him.
Mm.
And all of those themes will return in Matthew. So Jesus, rather than being the one who makes food for himself, will be the one who takes a few simple loaves and fish and feeds thousands. Instead of being the one who'll test God by throwing himself off a cliff, will willingly submit to death, trusting that God will do something with that. And that ultimately too, with the kingdom and the power, he rejects this worldly idea of kingdom, which is lording over it and having dominion, but instead will preach about the kingdom of heaven and model a very different way of living. So these, I guess I'm saying there's ways to take these three temptations that Jesus faces, this period of testing, and see how each of them is inverted in his ministry quite deliberately. And again, this is not about sin per se. He's not, you know, this is a testing, as you said, that's about identity. He can live fully as both the Son of God and God with us because he's passed the test that affirms his identity.
And resisted all those other ways of being that seem at first more attractive and achievable than the long-term goal.
So, look, there's obviously a ton of sermons in there. It also strikes me as that the third one there, which is about power and misusing and abusing power, is a bit of a theme that runs throughout the temptations, that given our world, I've recently watched the Bombshell movie and another The Loudest Voice series, which are all about Roger Ailes and the Fox and the, you know, sexual abuse that went on.
I've seen the trailer. I wasn't sure I was going to go along. Shall I go along?
Yeah, it's good, compelling stuff, but it is, you know, hard.
Yeah, because it's telling the truth about what's happening. Yeah.
That's right. So you don't have to look very far in our world to see huge examples of all sorts of abuse of power. So there's a very obvious preaching theme there about how Jesus not only utterly rejects the possibility of abusing his power or even using it for his own gain, but models a fundamentally different way of being in the world that is a willing giving up of power.
Yeah.
And again, at the start of Lent, one could talk about that as we look towards the cross, not too many weeks. Well,
you could do a lot worse than talk about that for 6 weeks.
Exactly.
So all the things we've talked about, shame and so on, can be focuses. I think there's a disassociation sort of going on between wisdom and knowledge and life as well in that first reading too, which I think can really lend itself to looking at how we live now and how we make judgments. So I heard a little anecdote the other day about how the banks are doing things a bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, the workers now have a sign at one bank that's a credit union that says, should I? That is, just because I can give them a bigger credit limit, for example? Should I?
Should I?
So there's something there about limits and wisdom and knowledge and what we do with it.
That's a nice example.
And remembering that we are in God's likeness and not God, and therefore what does that look like?
So that's right.
It's a big, but.
No, but that takes us back to the God has given us freedom and we now have this knowledge, but just because we can, should we? Is also a good theme. Mm. Well, I think we need to leave it there.
I think
so. It's been a long episode, but thank you for listening with us. This episode has been brought to you with the support of the Uniting Church in Australia and Pilgrim Theological College. Thank you for listening.